For it is God alone who has immortality and dwells in unapproachable light, whom no one has ever seen or can see. To God be honor and eternal dominion. In the name of God, Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer. Amen. Our readings are all about possessions and riches, money and land. The parable of the rich man and Lazarus, that story has been around for a long time in ancient cultures. It's sometimes known as the rich man and Dives. But it's about someone who has nothing and is just trying to make it through the day to be given some food to assuage the hunger he feels, some cool water to clean the sores on his body, just to have the things of basic existence. And he sits at the gate of a rich man who has passed him many days, who has everything that he could want in this life and more. When the rich man dies, he's buried and he goes to Hades. And he still sees Lazarus as his servant, as someone who should serve him and bring him some water. And it's a story about what happens when the tables are turned. Again, this is a parable in the extreme, as Irv said last week, to get our attention on this story of riches in our lives. Just after the service, I'm getting in the car and going driving to Connecticut for the Clergy Leadership Project's second week of this year. And we've had speakers in the spring on diversity and communication, and this time our speakers are on economics and sustainability. At first, I was a little worried about the economic part, but I found that it's been a very interesting reading getting ready for this conference. And in fact, in the past year, I've started to read the business section of the New York Times on Sunday. In fact, that's one of my favorite sections of the paper. Professor Harvey Cox, who many of you know has written about God and the city, is professor of divinity at Harvard University. And he's written an article now about 10 years old in Atlantic Monthly called The Market as God. And I had to read that as part of this preparation for my week in Connecticut. And he said somewhat the same thing about reading the business section. And it's interesting what he said. A few years ago, Cox said, a friend advised me that if I wanted to know what was going on in the real world, I should read the business pages. Although his lifelong interest has been religion, Cox said, I am always willing to expand my horizons. So I took the advice, vaguely fearful that I would have to cope with a new and baffling vocabulary. Instead of a strange new land of vocabulary, Cox found, he found deja vu. He found so many things in the language of economics that reminded him of theology. Instead of terra incognita, he said he entered the land of deja vu. He said that the lexicon of the Wall Street Journal and the business sections of Time and Newsweek turn out to bear a striking resemblance to the book of Genesis, the Epistle to the Romans, and St. Augustine's City of God. Behind the descriptions of market reform and monetary policy and the convolutions of the Dow Jones, Cox gradually made out the pieces of a grand narrative about the inner meaning of human history, why things had gone wrong, and how to put them right again. Theologians call these the myth of origin, the legends of the fall, and the doctrines of sin and redemption. But here they were again in the business pages of the New York Times, Time, Newsweek, the Wall Street Journal. And only in thin disguise, they were the chronicles of the creation of vast wealth, the captivity to faceless economic cycles, and ultimately salvation through the advent of free markets with a small dose of ascetic belt tightening. All of those things were in those pages, all the things that we study in theology. And here's what he came to say about the market as God. First of all, that market appears to be omnipotent, kind of like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. There's a divine omnipotence about the market. The market defines for so many of us what is real. Now, in the Episcopal Church and in some Roman Catholic churches, there's this doctrine of transubstantiation, where very ordinary things like bread and wine become holy things in the middle of the liturgy. Now, the market is all about the reverse. Things that have been held sacred become interchangeable items for sale. And one of those main things over the centuries that has become interchangeable item for sale is land. And we hear about that in the prophet Jeremiah today. For thousands of years, owning land and land have held various meanings. There's Mother Earth, there's the ancestral resting place, there's a holy mountain, an enchanted forest, a tribal homeland. But Cox says when market becomes involved and the market's sanctus bell rings at the end of the day and the elements are elevated, all of these complex meanings of what land means to us melt into one or two words: real estate. That's what land has become to me. For at the right price, any land is for sale, and this includes everything from a burial ground and more. Our relationship as humans to land is affected by this when we see it in a different light as just a commodity we buy and sell, make money or lose money on. And this sometimes happens with water, take the BP incident, air, space, and soon, perhaps heavenly bodies like the moon. They all become part of an interchangeable bill of sale, no longer sacred places to us, but just part of the market. And in the part of that market, what is the value of human life in the theology of the market? Important questions that we wrestle with as people have wrestled with for ages. So the market seems to be that God that defines what is real for us. In addition to defining what is real, the market is also omniscient, all-knowing. We need our seers and prophets of the market because from them we learn the market, the market's ways and personality. Some days on CNBC or MSNBC or whatever the acronym is, the market is apprehensive. Some days the market is relieved. Sometimes the market is nervous. Only infrequently is it jubilant. On the basis of all these revelations from our market seers, we make critical decisions to buy and sell. We look to the bull and the bear as our gods. But like Calvin would say, the market ways are mysterious and hid from our eyes. The thing about the market, though, even though it's hidden and describes our reality, is that it seems to know our very soul. It is though the market knows all our desires, and from where no secrets are hid, it knows that inner place. I've been thinking about that because we entered into the land of buying a car in the past couple of weeks. And I thought about what the reality and what the world tells you. It tells you there are so many cars to select from. It tells you there's so many sources that you can look at from the internet. There's Carfax. There's so many ways that you can determine if you're doing the right thing and making a good deal. And the car in this culture often says a lot about who we are. By driving a certain kind of car, we can kind of say what that person values and what's important to them. And so in the middle of trying to look for a car, I read this parable preparing for the sermon today. And I've been thinking about the cycles of parables and stories we're in that are all about money. And I was thinking about God as market and about the free market. And Jesus is not a free market kind of guy. He doesn't just say, let the market determine. He has some real values he wants to uphold that might actually be anti-market. From another tradition, a Zen master once said at the end of his life, I have learned one thing in my long life. How much is enough? For the market and God as the market, there is never enough. There is always more and more and more. Yesterday, my husband and I went for a walk, and we were recounting all the cars we had owned in our almost 30 years of marriage. There haven't been that many, but you know that you get attached to your cars when you have them for, like we mostly have ours about 10 years. Try to have them a little longer. And in the middle of that conversation, I remembered one thing. And I remembered the day that our cars drove away from us before we went to South Africa, and we handed over our car keys. And from about the time that I've been 16, I've always had possession of some kind of car keys in my life. I had no car keys for at least a month. And then as part of being a parish priest in South Africa, the parish car becomes the rector or the priest in charge car. And so I had this little Honda that was a nice little car, and my treasurer would come and pick it up every quarter and take it to be serviced and bring it back. And I had a gas car that the parish paid for. So I really did nothing with the car except drive it for all my pastoral and diocesan appointments. And then as I thought about that Honda, I thought about another car. And I thought about my bishop, Peter John Lee's car. It was probably the worst car in the diocese. It was given to him by a parish priest who left and went back to England, who actually lived in the townships. And it was a car that had seen many years, way over 10 years of life. Some of you have met Horace McBride, and Horace McBride, who's a priest in the diocese there, used to drive a truck. So about every Saturday night, every 3 weeks or so, he'd get a call from Bishop Peter. Horace, please come over. The car isn't working. Please come fix it. Because the bishop had to go out on his visitation on Sunday, probably two or three visitations. And the first time I rode in that car was the first Sunday I was in South Africa. And we had not gotten a car yet. And up our dirt road at the rectory comes this little blue Nissan. And it was kind of coughing as it came up the hill. And there behind the wheel was Bishop Peter. And in went all four of us, Anna at 6 years old, Jack at 9, and Brian and I. And we went down the road, I was wondering if the car would make it, the dusty South African roads, to a township called Bopalong, which had seen a lot of violence in the 90s before the election of Nelson Mandela. And we went into that little church where the singing was beyond belief. And afterwards, we walked to a woman's house whose husband had died, a little township house that was just a shack with tin roof and looked like nothing from the outside, but inside was as neat as a pin. And we sang as we comforted her, sang songs. I had no idea what they were, but I knew they were about the holy. And in that place, the everyday life of a township was transmuted. It was transformed into the holy, and God was with us. And after that, we got back in the car, and we somehow sputtered up the Golden Highway up to Walkerville, and were let off at our house at the rectory there. And I thought about that car as I was looking at all these cars that Americans have, and how the car says so much about you. But I thought about how that bishop's car, and I think he still had it last time I went back. I don't know how it's still working, but Horace is probably there every week now. But that car was about building the kingdom, was what it was about. It wasn't about who the bishop was, or how much money he made, or a whole vast number of things. It was the thing that allowed him to do his ministry. He kind of had it in the right place, and I don't know that I know any bishop in this country that probably has the worst car in the diocese. So, I've been thinking about God as market, and I don't think that Jesus would want the market to be our God. In fact, he talks so much about it not being our God, but about keeping our eyes on the kingdom work. Render the things to Caesar that are Caesar's, and the things that are God to God. It is so important that we don't let our sacred things become just another commodity to buy and sell and make us who we think we should be, but rather to find in our everyday things the holy again and again and again. Amen.